From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Ann Coulter, now you see her, now you don't. Hello again, Marwan Olney, back with To the Point. Ann Coulter is a right-wing provocateur who was scheduled to speak last week at UC Berkeley, where the free speech movement began in the 1960s. University officials say they canceled her appearance due to fear of violent protest, then re-invited her at a quieter time on campus. After angry exchanges about hypocrisy and media manipulation, Coulter never appeared. But Berkeley's not the only campus accused of liberal orthodoxy. Are students being shielded from challenging ideas, or are ideological agitators using the threat of violence to market their way of thinking? Later on today's Talking Point, one of the world's most controversial figures gets a White House invitation. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marwan Olney, back with To the Point. Many conservatives claim that American colleges and universities are bastions of liberal orthodoxy, shielding students from alternative ways of thinking. What better place for a protest than UC Berkeley? What better agent of controversy than Ann Coulter? That's our main program today. On our talking point later, President Rodrigo Duterte has encouraged extrajudicial killings in the Philippines. 8,000 or 9,000 people have been murdered in the name of his war on drugs. Now President Trump has invited Duterte to the White House. First is news update. Congressional leaders of both parties have agreed to a $1.1 trillion spending program. According to Bloomberg, it largely tracks Democratic priorities and rejects most of President Donald Trump's wish list. David Hawkins is senior editor at Roll Call. He blogs at Hawkins Here. Welcome, as always. Do you agree with that assessment?
I 100% agree with that assessment. I think President Trump essentially got half of one of the things he wanted, and that was it. He got a little less than half of one of the things he wanted, which was he asked for something like $30 billion in extra defense spending in the middle of the year, and he got about half of that, and only that much if he comes up with a plan that Congress at least thinks is credible for combating ISIS. Then he can have I think 12 and a half without that plan, and he can have 15 with that plan.
What about the wall?
No wall, explicitly no wall. The language says that the language of the bill says that the president can have, I think it's $1.5 billion extra for border security, but it is explicit in saying no money can be spent on anything that looks like progress toward a wall.
Are all the Republicans going to vote for this?
No. No, this is the unicorn moment in Congress where legislation is going to pass with probably about as many Democratic votes as Republican votes. This is classic compromise. This is what happens when it's not divided government. Obviously, the Republicans control both the House, the Senate, and of course the White House. But the filibuster is alive and well when it comes to spending bills. It might have been taken away for Supreme Court nominees, as we all know. But the Democrats still have essentially, effectively, a very heavy lever on power when it comes to regular legislation and especially spending bills, because they could stop this thing and then claim that it was Donald Trump and the Republicans who threatened a government shutdown.
Is this because of divisions among the Republicans?
I would say it absolutely is. I mean, the Republicans are divided in many different ways. There are several different ways, one of which is that there's a faction of very small government Republicans who would like to spend even less than this bill does. There's a faction of defense hawks who would like to spend a lot more. And there's a faction of sort of realist, centrist leadership types who, you know, want to not endanger their political standing by getting blamed for threatening to shut the government down, 100 days into this administration.
What about cuts for the National Institutes of Health and cuts for the EPA? The president supported very devastating cuts in those agencies.
He did for next year. And, of course, that's, you know, what we're talking about here is just the 5 months left in what's called fiscal 2017, which is this budget year, only lasts till September. On NIH, I think the NIH got a little bit of an increase. And as I understand it, EPA got a small spending cut, but no reductions in people. So once again, you know, the president's wishes were unfulfilled because the Democrats essentially put up their hands and said, if you want to be blamed for shutting the government down over such a thing, have at it, because you will be. We should remember that in past government shutdowns, Warren, it's been divided government. So at least plausibly, one side could point to the other and said they started this. But in this case, the Democrats are in the catbird seat because they have effective control over, you know, as I just said, because of the filibuster. But if they can say, you know, it's an all-Republican Washington, it's a Republican White House, a Republican Congress, so they got to own whatever we agree to.
What about Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell? Are they getting heat from conservatives?
You know, they will get a little bit of heat from conservatives, but I think probably what's going to happen is, as I said, this is just a five-month bill, and the super conservatives will vote no. They'll bellyache. They'll say that the Republican leadership sold them out, but then they will live to fight another day. And the fight over the budget for fiscal 2018, which starts on October 1st, will be somewhat of a rerun of what we just went through in the last few weeks, and probably the super confrontational conservatives will rally to try and pick a few fights that they feel like they might win.
I think our listeners would want to know, what about the subsidy for public broadcasting?
You know, that's not come up in any of the memos that I have, any of the bill summaries that I have read. Maybe I haven't read too deeply, but I have a feeling that if there was going to be a cut in the subsidy for public broadcasting, that would have made the Republican conservative boast list, and I haven't heard a word about it. So I'm assuming it's not there, but I haven't actually seen that particular line in the bill.
Okay, but they're still going to work this week on repealing Obamacare or in replacing it in some way.
Well, they're going to try. You know, I think there's some Republicans who are kind of annoyed that the president is sort of keeps wishing it were true before it really is true.
Okay.
I think now the spending bill is over. The spending debate is over. That will reconcentrate the Republicans on health care, but they don't have the votes for that one yet.
David Hawkins at Roll Call. Many thanks as always.
Thank you, Warren.
In a moment, Ann Coulter. Now you see her, now you don't. On To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. The free speech movement of the 1960s began at UC Berkeley. So when campus officials canceled a scheduled appearance last week by the right-wing advocate Ann Coulter, they were accused of hypocrisy. She then rejected their second invitation to come at a quieter time. That set off an angry dispute reflected on other campuses as well. It's based on conservative claims that institutions of higher learning are bastions of liberal thinking that won't tolerate anything else. Nicholas Dirks is the chancellor at UC Berkeley. He's going to spend a few minutes with us. And thank you very much, Chancellor, for being with us.
Great to be with you.
Why was the speech originally canceled?
Well, it actually goes back, I think, to an earlier speech that we were hosting for Milo Yiannopoulos on February 1st, which, as you might recall, was a somewhat fraught event, to say the least. We had brought in extra police to basically to allow the event to happen, to keep the protesters from disrupting it. And, of course, we then had about 150 people who came on campus dressed in black block using those kinds of tactics to shut the thing down. And they set a big fire. They broke windows. They actually began to get into the student union where the event was to take place. And we had to shut it down at the last minute to preserve public safety. After $100,000 worth of damage and a review of our protocols around having speakers who were seen as controversial by either the campus itself or people off campus, we came up with some new rules, which had to do, for example, with scheduling during the day, not at night, scheduling in a venue that our police could protect, and making sure that we followed a set of protocols that were ramped up to fit the possible disruption that could come from off campus in particular. So when the Berkeley College Republicans invited Ann Coulter to speak, we only found out about it a few weeks ahead of time after the date had been set and then a contract had been signed without certainly anybody in my administration seeing this. And we tried to find a venue. We could not find one at a time and at a place that would fit the protocols that we'd established. And so we suggested an alternative date and time. And it turns out that we found out on Fox News and Twitter that had been rejected.
Rejected, according to those who, including Ann Coulter, who said she didn't want to speak, that Berkeley was really trying to limit the audience that she would be available to, that in fact it is controlled by a faculty that tilts to the left. Is that true?
You know, Berkeley has been known for its liberal perspectives on the part of many faculty, though in fact we host conservative speakers all the time. This is a campus that is deeply committed to free speech, but it also wants to make sure it can preserve public safety. And what we saw in February was an occurrence that certainly put at risk our students and other communities and constituencies here. So I could say that, we wanted her to come. We wanted her to come to a big audience. And we tried to arrange that and found it very difficult to engage with her or her organization directly to figure out something that would work. We proposed a date just 5 days later. She rejected it because it was seen as a time when students go away from campus. In fact, it's reading week. All students are here. And we could find many more venues because we weren't competing with classroom use and spaces that had already been committed months ago for other kinds of events. So we're sorry there was no flexibility, and we wish she could have come.
Do you believe that she and others are, in fact, agitators rather than scholars who want to offer serious opinions to the students?
You know, it's not for me to define what an agitator is and what a provocative speaker is vis-a-vis scholars. We don't invite only scholars. We invite many public figures. We invite people who have different kinds of views and people who are, public intellectuals as well as arcane scholars. So that's not a distinction that I think I would want to endorse. Clearly, however, there were people who used our difficulty in finding an accommodation that worked for both of us to decry us as being intolerant and not, in fact, open for business for free speech.
Will Berkeley and other campuses have to be prepared for this kind of thing in the future?
I think we're in a new reality. We had the Milo Yiannopoulos riots. That we then had two near riot situations in downtown Berkeley, where there were face-offs and angry confrontations and some violence between the so-called anti-fascist groups and the so-called pro-Trump or whatever groups that came. And of course, we had more than 300 police here on April 27th, even without Ann Coulter. And we're prepared for, possible violence. The fact is that the presence of the police deterred that, and we were successful in having a day that saw no violence on campus. But I think we're in for more and more efforts to assault us from outside the university.
Nicholas Dirks, again, the chancellor at the University of California, Berkeley. Thanks so much for being on our program.
Great to be with you.
Susan Sferluga is a reporter covering higher education for The Washington Post. Hi, good to have you with us. Do you agree with the chancellor that we are facing a new reality, that it has now moved on to campuses? And do you think that there are others? In fact, there have been a couple of others, Auburn and Middlebury in Vermont, who've had similar kinds of experiences. Do you think we're going to see more and more of this? Susan Sferluga, we don't seem to be able to get the connection made. Let me turn to Pranav Jean Diala, who is a freshman at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the founder and co-president of Bridge USA, and one of the people who wanted to see Ann Coulter speak. Thanks so much for joining our program.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad to be on.
How do you feel about what we just heard from the chancellor?
You know, I have several things I'd like to respond with. You know, we were co-hosting the event with the College Republicans, and we co-invited Ann Coulter. We were definitely not expecting the kind of fallout we experienced with the media and the kind of fallout we experienced in general. You know, Ann Coulter is this individual who has a large following, and, you know, we wanted to have that conservative voice in this nation. You know, the far-right conservative voice in this nation represented in this debate, and, you know, having the two polar opposites, you know, essentially engage in discussion could provide a model for what free discourse could look like. You know, with regard to the concerns that the administration, and you just heard from Chancellor Dirks, the university is in a very tricky bind. It is being attacked from both sides right now. While their primary responsibility is promoting student safety, they still have, you know, a responsibility to promote the values of the First Amendment and free speech. And when these violent groups like Antifa and By Any Means Necessary use threats of violence and actually engage in this type of violence like you saw during the Milo riots, it becomes very difficult to do both at the same time. Now, what I will say, though, is that giving in to these threats of violence in canceling this kind of speech, you know, sets a dangerous precedent. Will threats of violence always, you know, prevent controversial speech, you know, specifically conservative speakers in this environment from taking place? And that's the issue that, you know, I'm trying to grapple with right now, and many of my peers are trying to grapple with. It just sets a dangerous precedent when the university isn't going to do everything that it can, and I believe it's not. You know, UCPD has a stand-down order that prevents them from actually getting involved when violence breaks out unless something is life-threatening. So there's definitely more that could be done, and right now it's just setting a dangerous precedent.
Well, the chancellor just said they had 300 cops on campus, even when Ann Coulter wasn't there. They lost $100,000 during the Milo Yiannopoulos flap. So, as you say, they do have their problems. They are trying to do something about it if they had 300 cops on the campus.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the response this time was a lot better. They had officers on the ground. You know, during the Milo riots, officers were only on the balcony. You know, many students, including myself, you know, I was filming as a journalist, and I was actually beaten by some Antifa members during that night, and I got a concussion. And, you know, the police response was just really horrible that night in defending the campus and protecting student safety, at least in my opinion.
Excuse me, what's Antifa?
Yeah. Antifa is this group called, you know, the anti-fascists. They're this group that, you know, they're the Black Bloc rioters. They're the people that storm campus and, you know, engage in violence to prevent speech that, you know, they view as racist or bigoted, essentially.
Let me introduce Jason Johnson. He's politics editor at TheRoot.com and politics and journalism professor at Morgan State University in Baltimore. Good to have you on our show.
Glad to be here.
Do you agree that the university and not just Berkeley, but others as well, perhaps even including Morgan State, are, in fact, in a bind, as we just heard?
Well, yeah, they're in a practical and financial bind. It's really expensive to run a university. And knowing that you're going to have to, you know, in most universities, state schools, they're not for profit per se. And knowing that you're going to have to shell out thousands of extra dollars just to have a non-paid speaker come to campus is daunting, and that could have a chilling effect. And we've seen this historically. This has happened with both the right and the left. Stokely Carmichael came to my college at the University of Virginia back when I was going. He's a former head of the Black Panther Party, and there were people who didn't want him there. So it's very, very difficult for universities to navigate this. I do think that there's a certain amount of trolling going on the part of some of these right-wing speakers. But that doesn't change the fact that universities have to somehow balance their financial needs, keeping students safe, and maintaining an open environment for discussion.
Do you think that Ann Coulter was doing some trolling?
Oh, completely. This was a scam. I mean, you know, look, Ann Coulter knows that she's getting more play, more attention, and can drive up her speaker's fees by getting kicked out of Berkeley. than if she had actually gone there and spoken and people had heard how generally feckless and uninteresting she has been. So there's a difference between Milo Yiannopoulos, who is a very popular new face who's still growing his audience, in that riot. But Ann Coulter, this was just an attempt for her to gain more attention for herself, and that's why she chose Berkeley. There are tons of campuses around America where you wouldn't face Antifa, where you wouldn't face this kind of – she could go to Duke, she could go to Stanford. So she picked Berkeley because she wanted this kind of controversy, because that's how she can promote herself.
Let me go back to Pranav John Diala. What do you have to say to that?
You know, I actually disagree to some extent, but I also do agree. Eventually it did become part of this larger media show. It became part of, this larger attempt at provocation. But initially, at least when we were talking to Ann Coulter, when we were arranging the speech details, when we were setting up the event and promoting it and talking with administration, at least in my conversation with her and her team, she definitely did want to have a successful event. She was doing everything that she could, even at the last minute, trying to work with us, and eventually it didn't come through. But, to say that, from the get-go, she expected this result is, I think, a little bit untrue. I do think, though, I agree with the point that because this speech didn't occur, it's bad for all parties. Because the speech was canceled, because she wasn't able to speak because of safety concerns, ultimately, it just strengthens the other side. It increases political polarity when you aren't able to bring views in and challenge them. And, now in the media, the administration and student bodies painted as, some radical leftist faction that's basically in some conspiracy to prevent speech from occurring, which isn't true. And also, the alt-right and the conservative right are able to make a case against universities in general now. She is only strengthened because of this in terms of publicity. So I definitely agree with that.
Pranav John Diala, once again, freshman at UC Berkeley, founder and co-president of Bridge USA at that campus. Susan Sraluga is a reporter covering higher education for The Washington Post. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Is Bridge USA and other organizations like it appearing at other places around the country?
I think people are eager to bring in all kinds of different speakers to campus, especially as the perception increases that campuses are more and more liberal and that conservative speech isn't tolerated as well.
So where else has this occurred?
Where else have there been controversies over speakers? I think there have been some really dramatic controversies over speakers at places such as the University of Washington, where a protester was shot and badly hurt. Before a Milo Yiannopoulos speech in January. At Middlebury, a professor got a concussion after a mob charged her and a conservative writer, Charles Murray, in March. So we're definitely seeing an increase in protests and violence and extreme reactions to controversial speakers.
Very quickly, who did the shooting at University of Washington?
I don't remember that. In each of these cases, there's violence, I think, from both the right and the left, and tensions get really inflamed.
So is this then a reflection on campus of the polarization we see across the country?
I think so, definitely. I definitely think it's heightened, during the campaign and since the election. We've seen an increase in sort of the drama and the severity and the violence.
All right, we're going to take a very brief break. Then we'll find out what it's like to teach right now on a campus which is subject to these kinds of pressures. Later on our Talking Point, one of the world's most controversial figures is invited to the Trump White House, the president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte. This is To the Point from PRI. Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about free speech on campus and polarization to the extent that there is violence associated with people who have different points of view. Wendy Beth Hyman is an associate professor of English at Oberlin College. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, glad to be here.
Tell us what's happening on your campus and what it means in the classroom.
Well, I think that in day-to-day teaching, there's not really a lot of impact of the kinds of divisiveness that are happening when a very polarizing speaker comes to campus. I've been thinking a lot about, despite the way that certain campuses are lampooned as being extreme, that almost all the students I've really ever taught have been so serious and thoughtful, really trying to figure out how to respond to the world. And honestly, the biggest change I think that has emerged in my teaching in the last several years has been trying to call more deliberate attention to how knowledge is made or presented. That is to say, I will now often bring something up in class and then ask my students, so what unstated assumptions did that argument rely on? What kinds of evidence did I use to make that claim? I think about how teaching something like Shakespeare enables to think about thinking, and I really want to call attention to making sure that we're all bringing our best selves to the table and not just responding in some of the most extreme reactions in, that we've seen in a really polarized time for our country.
One of the subjects you have to teach, as you indicated, is Shakespeare. Titus
right.
Andronicus is one of the plays that he wrote. It's one of the most violent and it's full of rape and carnage, and in English literature, it's a sort of a classic of its kind in that respect. How do you teach it?
Yeah, that's a great example. It is kind of a bloodbath, honestly. And, you know, for many, many years, it is a play that I have introduced to people kind of the way that I would, if I were taking a friend to see a Quentin Tarantino film for the first time, I might say, hey, just as a heads up, this is pretty intense, and this is a play that contains gang rape and mutilation, torture. So it's not a walk in the park. It's also fascinating study of violence, and some people think might even be parodic in some way, kind of about a almost early modern comic book. So I do let my students know in advance something about the content, but I've not ever had a student who insisted on not reading it, and I would not welcome that kind of response.
Just on a personal note, my parents took me to see Titus Andronicus in New York when I was 15 years old.
Oh,
and,
wow.
I was absolutely astonished by what happened. I want to go back to Jason Johnson at TheRoot.com, also at Morgan State University. What about you? Do you think that students need and deserve trigger warnings of some kind when subjects like this come up?
Yeah, I think it's fine, but I think the term trigger warning has become a trigger in and of itself. Like, all good teachers have always warned their students, and sometimes if you're in high school, their parents, about potential content. I mean, you know, Song of Solomon, you know, that includes incest. That includes, you know, sort of bizarre sexual situations. You know, warning your students, saying, hey, look, this may include this kind of scene or that kind of scene. That's always been a part of good teaching, because you want your students to be prepared for how their minds, their beliefs, and their attitudes are going to be challenged by the information that they're presented. But just like political correctness or safe spaces, these words have been demonized by the far right and turned into something new and nefarious when that's actually been a standard part of education for the last 50 years.
So do teachers become thought police at some point?
I mean, you can, but if you were going to be a thought police teacher, you're probably going to be a thought police cop, parent, doctor, or something else like that. I don't think that most people who have dedicated their lives to getting a doctorate are interested in turning out a whole bunch of little clones or slaves in their classroom. What they're interested in is making sure that students have a foundation, a strong intellectual or empirical foundation for whatever it is that they're already going to believe anyway. I tell my students all the time, I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat, I just want you to leave as an informed Republican or a Democrat. When you go home for Thanksgiving break, I want you to be able to argue with your uncle and sound like a smart person. And I don't think my attitude is unique. I think a lot of professors, they want kids to challenge themselves, not to fall in line with some particular set of thinking process.
So, Wendy Beth Hyman at Oberlin, how much pressure is there, do you think, one way or the other, by conservatives, by liberals, to make sure that kids come out a certain way, rather than, as Jason Johnson suggests, people able to deal with both sides of any question?
Right. I mean, I would agree completely with Professor Johnson that what I'm actually interested in the most is what is it that informs your thinking, but also what is it that would allow you to change your mind? So I think most of us don't just try to teach people how to argue better, but
but also to know where is the point in which they would be receptive to some other point of view. I would say that I don't feel any pressure from the left or the right in regards to what I do in my classroom.
Are you concerned that there is a tendency for some teachers in some places to become thought police, or more to the point, I suppose, that there's a demand for that, whether you want to be one or not?
I'm concerned that we seem to live in a time where so few people feel comfortable or even able to act in good faith when it comes to treating their fellow citizens. And I would definitely say that there are some academic environments, just like there are some environments of all kinds, where faculty are being very cautious and self-censoring about what they might say. And that's probably deleterious on the whole.
Let me go to Pranav Jandiala, who is, once again, a freshman at University of California at Berkeley, co-president of Bridge USA, one of the people who invited Ann Coulter to come. What do you see at Berkeley? And do you feel that the faculty there, as is often charged, is, in fact, excessively liberal, demanding that people think a certain way, and resistant to conservative ideas?
You know, I think that UC Berkeley's painted a certain way in the media, and the entire nation views us a certain way, but I'd like to say that this perception is false. There's many conservative faculty members that I know personally that I work with, and, you know, for the most part, the teachers that I've had, they're driven by this spirit of intellectual inquiry, and they drive us that same way. They don't want us to look at something all the same way, and, you know, to view something through a certain lens and not have that continually change over time as we learn more about the subject or challenge and test our views. But, you know, at the same time, there are a few professors that I've had that I do think, you know, operate under some assumptions, operate under the assumption that, you know, all students think a certain way and move forward with their teaching based on these liberal assumptions. I do think that overall, though, this isn't as big as of a problem as this perception, you know, makes it out to be.
How would you feel if a political science professor, for example, were so opposed to the Trump administration that he or she made deleterious comments about it and said, you know, I think that the Trump administration is wrong for the following reasons, or if that had been true during the years of Obama?
And, you know, I think that this is the case. Some professors do make those kinds of statements, but then say something along the lines of, you know, this is my opinion. You know, if you're conservative, keep on fighting with your cause as well. There are faculty who are very open about their political views. You know, when Milo Yiannopoulos was planning to come here, there's this large document of faculty signatures, you know, that was sent to the administration saying, hey, we shouldn't let him come here, prevent him from speaking. So people are very politically open in terms of their views. But at the same time, I think there are enough professors who will say things like, you know, this is my point of view, feel free to disagree with me, come talk to me. There are enough professors like that, that this environment isn't so much of a liberal echo chamber as people think it is.
Jason Johnson, what do you think of the idea of faculty members telling the administration that a speaker should not be allowed to come? This was, of course, before Yiannopoulos did, in fact, come. And as the chancellor described it earlier, the situation was fraught, and it cost the campus $100,000 to clean up.
I think it's perfectly fine. I mean, you know, if you don't want the office Christmas party to be held downtown, you tell your boss. If you don't want someone to be hired, you tell your boss. If a group of faculty don't want a speaker coming there and they have their reasons why, they tell their boss. I think that's perfectly reasonable. If anything, I would say this has been my experience, and I've taught at small liberal arts colleges, I've taught at HBCUs, I've taught at private schools, I've taught at public schools. In my experience, when you talk about diversity of opinions amongst faculty, I've experienced Republican, conservative, liberal, Democratic faculty. The greatest resistance is often from conservative students who, when faced with information or worldviews that they don't hold, feel that they are being attacked. And that, I think, is infinitely more common in my academic experience than liberal students who claim they're being triggered. When you have students in your classroom and you say, Steve Bannon is a white nationalist and he supports ideas of white terrorist organizations, that's a fact. That's not an opinion. And there are students who will say, well, then you're saying this about Donald Trump, and they'll get upset, and they feel that they're attacked. And part of what you're trying to do as a faculty member is get them to understand just because it's information that you don't like doesn't mean it's a personal assault. But that's also part of them growing up, and that's why you go to college. So, you know, I've never thought that any student was beyond being spoken to, but I do think that I have encountered more resistance from students on the right who 9 times out of 10 tend to hold their worldviews a bit more tight than students on the left.
So, Pranav Jandiala, you're a student on the right, it would appear. Do you feel attacked when, in fact, such things as the professor just suggested are said by other professors in a class?
Well, I wouldn't describe myself as right wing. I would call myself a centrist. You know, I run a nonpartisan organization. I have to be relatively moderate. But the thing is, though, that I think it's important to talk about the students as well and the surrounding environment. I have a lot of conservative friends, a lot of friends in the Berklee College Republicans, for example. You know, a lot of what they face on a day-to-day basis and a lot of what they feel in this environment isn't unjustified. And it's not just from faculty and professors. I think, you know, it's one thing to claim that the largely liberal faculty is, you know, exacerbating this echo chamber. But, you know, I think more of the truth lies in students around them and this larger student body that is, you know, 90 to 95% liberal at UC Berklee, essentially creating an environment that is not very welcoming to people with different points of view. I think it's rather the students and the student body rather than the faculty who, you know, make the echo chamber what it is. And, you know, a lot of the time, for example, when the Berklee College Republicans are tabling or flyering, you know, they get flipped off, they get pushed around, their signs get torn up. And, you know, this is something that they face on a day-to-day basis. You know, Antifa, for example, doxed a lot of Berklee College Republicans members. They made flyers and said, you know, these are their names and, you know, personal information. They're baby fascists, and they invited Ann Coulter to campus, you know, all these things. So I think it's the larger environment that's more playing into what these conservatives feel on campus.
Professor Hyman at Oberlin, is that the kind of environment students have at your place? If they don't, why not?
Well, I'm really actually glad to hear Pranav make those distinctions that he's made, sort of calling out the lie that professors are all trying to indoctrinate students into a liberal mindset or, you know, not recognizing the distinction between how a faculty member with a PhD who's used to handling different points of view might respond to something and how a 20-year-old might respond to something that they find upsetting. So I'm really heartened by that. And I think in general, it's really helpful for us to remember that just because we don't, invite someone like Ann Coulter to campus doesn't mean that we are censoring. We don't carry lots of books in the bookstore. It doesn't mean that we are censoring them. So as far as how students respond here, we have had some pretty strong reactions to campus speakers. And I wish I could actually give you details because I don't remember what the specifics were. But I know that there have been some uncomfortable and troubling protests. I'll mention one that I found very disturbing, very upsetting, because it was actually, I think, short-sighted on the side of the left. A student of mine put on a performance, directed a performance of Eve Ensler's Vagina Monologues a few years ago. And she was critiqued, and the performance was protested by students who were upset that it wasn't representative of trans folks who are women but do not have vaginas. And although I really respect and appreciate how important my students understand it is to be inclusive, a little bit of historical recognition of what it might be, what might be worth bringing on a play from the 80s. It does not see gender the way we do now.
you know, more respect on all sides would have been welcome.
Jason Johnson, very quickly at Morgan State, your response to that. We're just about out of time.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Depending on what kind of environment you're in, that's where you get the kind of arguments and diversity. You know, if you have a large number of white students, then maybe that could be a race issue. If you have a large number of LGBT students, maybe that could be the other question. But I think the overall, and I'm happy to hear that everybody's pretty much in agreement on this particular issue, this is not nearly as controversial as I think some of the right-wing press wants to make it out to be. Most campuses are filled with reasonable 19- and 20-year-old kids trying to figure out their place in the world. They're not screaming that they're triggered. They're not saying that they need to be in safe spaces, which we've always had. And most faculty are dedicated to creating bright, active, considerate, nuanced human beings that go out in the world. And just because you have professional provocateurs like Ann Coulter who want to try to use one particular situation to promote their brand, that doesn't represent some sea change going on college campuses, because the vast majority of us are still putting our nose to the grindstone, staying up late and reading books and working with our students, and most students are just working hard to find out where they believe things. This is something the right wing is creating. It's not a new phenomenon.
We're going to leave it at that. Jason Johnson, politics editor at The Root, professor at Morgan State University. Wendy Beth Hyman, professor at Oberlin College. Pranav Jandiala, who is at the University of California at Berkeley with Bridge USA, one of those who invited Ann Coulter to come. And Nicholas Dirks, we heard from earlier, the chancellor of the University of California at Berkeley. Great to have you all, and thank you very much for being with us. In a moment, the controversial invitation to visit the Trump White House on To the Point from Public Radio International. We're on only here with today's talking point. Speaking to a group of Filipino workers returning from overseas a year ago, the president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, told them, "If you lose your job, I'll give you one. Kill all the drug addicts." In June, he said, "If you know any addicts, go ahead and kill them yourself, as getting their parents to do it would be too painful." Some 8,000 or 9,000 Filipinos have died in extrajudicial killings. Now President Trump has invited Duterte to visit the White House after a phone call described as warm by Trump's aides. Phelim Kine is Deputy Director of the Asia Division of Human Rights Watch. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren. Thank you for having me.
What's your reaction to the invitation to the president of the Philippines?
Well, you know, it's dismaying that the first substantive communications between President Trump and President Duterte did not even hint at U.S. concern about the human rights calamity that Duterte has inflicted on the Philippines through his abusive war on drugs. That all there was apparent, what looked like an implicit nod of approval by Trump toward the war on drugs, and then an invitation, which is easily interpreted as an honor. And considering the horrific death toll and the suffering inflicted by Duterte's drug war, it's really it's inconceivable that he would merit that type of treatment.
The White House Chief of Staff, Reince Priebus, was asked about that yesterday on ABC.
It doesn't mean that human rights don't matter, but what it does mean is that the issues facing us developing out of North Korea are so serious that we need cooperation at some level with as many partners in the area as we can get to make sure that we have our ducks in a row.
Phelim Kine, back to you. What about the relationship between the Philippines and the situation involving North Korea?
Well, this comes down to the U.S. government and diplomacy. And the U.S. government should be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. And by that, I mean that they need to ensure that they are expressing concern and making clear to close bilateral partners that the U.S. cares about and prioritizes human rights and respect for rule of law and doesn't throw those types of concerns under the bus because they perceive a more pressing issue, on the other side of the horizon. There are, you know, this again comes down to skillful diplomacy and managing dual crises. And what's happened is that the Philippine people and the more than 7,000 victims of the Duterte war on drugs have been effectively silenced and thrown under the bus by some kind of geopolitical strategy by the Trump administration. That's unacceptable.
You said 7,000. I said earlier between 8,000 and 9,000. That seems to be a difference, A, because it's difficult to count, and B, because before he became president of the country, Mr. Duterte had a policy like this in the town where he was mayor. What do you say to the fact that the Filipino voters knew that when they elected him? He doesn't seem to be facing any kind of, well, there certainly has been opposition, an angry opposition by a lot of people, but it would appear that if he were to run again, he might be reelected. Is the U.S., would the U.S. rather, be interfering in the politics of another country?
Well, Warren, we need to be clear that President Duterte was elected with a plurality of the vote. So 38% of Filipinos voted him into office. That means 62% of those who went to the polls in May 2016 voted for someone else. Now, that doesn't diminish the fact that there is he strikes a very visceral note with many Filipinos who feel that the traditional status quo and that traditional politics, as usual in the Philippines, have failed many people, that people have been left behind in terms of globalization, economic disparity, and that his persona as a tough-talking, profane-talking, a nonconformist really strikes a chord with a lot of people because they're tired of business as usual. But having said that, even if he is popular, popularity doesn't equal legitimacy. And the fact is that President Duterte was elected and is obligated as president of the Philippines to respect the Philippine Constitution. The Philippine Constitution has built-in provisions for respecting rule of law, for respecting rights of suspects. President Duterte has explicitly decreed that suspected drug users and drug dealers are less than human and should be killed. And that's a really horrifying approach to so-called governance.
The Philippine Constitution, written in large part by the United States after World War II. Given what you have said and your work for Human Rights Watch, has there been any international effort to try to call Mr. Duterte to account for what has been apparently a sort of murder spree in his country?
Well, we know that the Office of the Prosecutor of the International Criminal Court has officially expressed concern to the Philippines government and to Duterte about possible crimes against humanity. We know also that there is a building momentum amongst member states of the United Nations to try to get an independent United Nations investigation into the killings, as the UN has done in the past in places like Sri Lanka and also in North Korea. So there is building international concern. There's building international support for mechanisms that are outside mechanisms, because to a large extent, the Philippine National Police, which is implicated in thousands of unlawful deaths, and the government are so deeply implicated in these killings that it seems highly improbable that they themselves can meaningfully and reliably provide some measure of accountability on their own. So that's the state of play. And you might recall that last week a Filipino lawyer presented a file of evidence at the International Criminal Court calling for an ICC investigation. So things are moving. How quickly, we can't tell, but things are moving.
You're with the Asian Division of Human Rights Watch, but President Trump has also called and congratulated President Erdogan of Turkey after he got a referendum passed, which gives him vast new powers to run that country. He's also invited to the White House and praised very much President al-Sisi of Egypt, who's carried out a very ruthless crackdown on Islamists and dissidents in his country. What does this tell you about the Trump administration?
Well, it's still early days, but all of those items you mentioned, these are worrying signals that perhaps under the Trump administration, the United States government's traditional role as a standard bearer for universal human rights both nationally and internationally, is on the wane in comparison to previous administrations. And that's something that is a huge disappointment, but it also could have profoundly negative implications for human rights defenders, civil society activists in autocratic, authoritarian countries around the world who have long looked to the United States as a symbol of universal human rights values and also as a potential source of support for people who really need it when their governments have them against the wall, literally and figuratively.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, Phelim Kine, again, with the Asia Division of Human Rights Watch. Once again, the President of the United States has invited the President of the Philippines to the White House. No dates set. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.